Today, Crunch Time, the Property Imperative Daily for the 11th of March 2020. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to our latest post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Given the current market gyrations, we're going to examine the latest critical data each day for the next few days, because a week is a long time in politics, but a lifetime on the markets at the moment. The local markets closed lower today, with ASX 100 down 3.61%, ending at 4,751. The Financial Services Index dropped 5.26% to 4,947, while the Volatility Index rose 19.33% to 3,583, so a lot of concern about future risks. And the Aussie-US dollar was at 65.03. So, across the board, a down day, with big swings once again typical of a bear market. And there was a harbinger of what may come, as Italy is on lockdown, the first country to introduce such measures on a nationwide basis. The rules that all 60 million citizens have to follow, including imposing restrictions on retail, leisure, worship, imprisonment, and travel, means that getting about is almost impossible. And Italian mortgage payments will be suspended across the whole of Italy after the outbreak. Italy's deputy economic minister said on Tuesday, yes, that will be the case for individuals and households, she said in a radio interview when asked about the possibility. And Italy's banking lobby ABI said on Monday that lenders representing 90% of total banking assets, would offer debt moratoriums to small firms and households grappling with the economic fallout from the outbreak. Now think about the impact on their banks. And talking of banks, RBA Deputy Governor Guy Debelle gave a keynote address at the Australian Financial Review Business Summit today. It was a summary of how the bank is seeing developments in the economy now. And as normal, the story was that the economy was doing quite well until the onset of the virus. And once it passes, things will revert back to that trend. But they admit that the global economy will be materially weaker in the first quarter of 2020 and in the period ahead. Australia, they said, will see at least a 0.5% fall in growth in the current quarter, but then went on to say it's just too uncertain to assess the impact beyond the March quarter. Despite the fact that spreads on Australian bank bonds have widened, yields remain at levels that are still very low historically, and banks are strongly capitalised. Weirdly, he failed to discuss the Federal Reserve's ongoing repo operations and its growing balance sheet. John Adams and I released a show on just this topic today. And Debelle was at pains to say Australian banks are well capitalised to withstand the disruption caused to financial markets, saying the country's lenders had boosted their finances before the recent disruption in wholesale funding markets and their deposit inflows were robust as well. They are resilient to a period of market disruption, Debelle said. And Treasurer Josh Frydenberg did not immediately provide details of his meeting with the chief executives of 13 of the country's biggest banks, and shares in the big four banks from CBA, Westpac, National Australia Bank and ANZ have dived between 15 and 22% since the beginning of February, when things started to go wrong. But regulators and the banks themselves are confident the sector is prepared for a shock after lenders bolstered their core Tier 1 capital ratios to a minimum 10.5% from January. Now, they, of course, run stress tests. But as we've discussed before, each bank is run in isolation, whereas now we have a cross-border, complex, global crisis. And as a result, I'm not sure that their tests will tell us very much about what may happen ahead. Nevertheless, Australian Banking Association CEO Anna Bligh said the country's lenders were in the best ever shape to face this challenge. And we keep seeing denials of any similarities between what is happening now and the pre-GFC era. But to my mind, history is certainly rhyming. It's worth remembering that we escaped the worst of the GFC thanks to first Rudd's cash splash, currently being resisted by ScoMo, of course, massive investment by China, whereas they're saying this time there will be more focused investments, a 4% interest rate cut when we are actually at 0.5% currently and could dip into negative rates and QE from the RBA. And finally, last time, Westpac and NAB both got a hand from the Fed, who injected capital into a number of banks globally, including, by the way, Deutsche Bank. And we think that this is less likely this time around, given Trump's America First mantra. So I think we are in a worse place than pre-GFC, and the RBA, like last time, is not alert sufficiently to the issues. Now, I think the Reserve Bank in New Zealand is better placed. In a recent speech, Adrian Orr said the Reserve Bank typically implements monetary policy by controlling the official cash rate. But as interest rates fall, this tool could be pushed to its limits in the future. Given this, in recent years, the Reserve Bank has been considering the unconventional monetary policy tools and policy framework that it would use to meet its policy targets. The work to develop Reserve Bank's preparation for unconventional monetary policies has involved, firstly, identifying the suite of possible unconventional monetary policy tools available to the Reserve Bank, defining and making explicit the criteria the Reserve Bank would use to assess those tools against both each other and also alternative policies altogether, for example, fiscal policy options. Next, considering the relative benefits and costs of the tools so as to operate on a least surprised basis and to ensure the Reserve Bank works in collaboration and with the agreement of fiscal authorities. And then considering not just the monetary policy efficacy of the tools, but also broader considerations related to financial stability and efficiency mandates, and to ensure that the tools are able to be utilised, including working with the important financial institutions that make up the banking system. And he said, we're confident of our success in assessment and implementation, but we're also aware that these tools work best when supported by stabilisation policies and additional macroprudential considerations. In the event we ever had to use these unconventional tools, our goal would be to ensure a strong and sustained increase in economic activity, with inflation expectations remaining well anchored in our target midpoint. And they said in coming weeks, the Reserve Bank will release a series of technical papers explaining the tools in more detail, examining their pros and cons, and outlining how they would potentially be used. And the ABS released their January lending data today, both to households and businesses. And on a combined basis, the total value of home loans was up 4.6% over the month and 23% over the year. It was stronger than analysts had been expecting based on the earlier gross loans exposures reported by the RBA previously. This means that more households are paying loans down because overall growth was quite anemic, even as new loans are being taken up by others. And new loan approvals surging at 4.6% over the month was above the consensus forecast of 3% across both volumes and values. The number of owner-occupied loans was up 3.1% over the month and up 11% from their low last May. The value of owner-occupied loans was up 28% over the same period, implying a sizable 17% rise in average loan values. In other words, APRA's weaker standards are allowing the banks to lend bigger loans out. Gains in the owner-occupied segment have been across both upgraders and first home buyers, the latter showing a slightly stronger 20% in the number of approvals since May. But while investor activity was picking up just a little, the value of loans to investors rose 3.6% over the month and is now up 22% from its May lows, but is still 37% below its 2017 peak. And across the states, we find that New South Wales and Victoria continue to lead the rebound, with the total value of loans in New South Wales up 7% over the month and 30% over the year, and in Victoria up 5.3% over the month and 27% over the year. But the value of loans dipped 2% in Queensland, though still up a solid 17% over the year, and Western Australia and South Australia have seen more moderate 10% gains over the year. Construction-related financial approvals stirred a little, with loans for the purchase of newly built dwellings, including off-the-plan purchases, posting a 13.4% rise and construction loans up 4.2%. So you could say, on one hand, the story is pointing to a clear turning point in non-high-rise building activity, and the lift in purchase of newly built dwellings will also help high-rise developers clear unsold stock, but is less likely to drive a lift in new projects. So you can conclude that the finance figures confirm that the housing market was definitely carrying some momentum into early 2020, but of course the worsening virus shock will likely be a major disruption to activity in coming months. And yet the property champions are already out arguing the virus won't kill property. realestate.com.au chief economist Nera Cosby said a recession would have to drive an increase in unemployment to cause major shockwaves in the housing market. A more likely scenario was that a recession would sour sentiment, slowing growth in property values. And housing market economist Andrew Wilson said risk-averse lending from banks meant fewer Aussie mortgagees were highly leveraged, which would make a housing bubble unlikely. Recent interest rate cuts would also drive more buyers into the market to capitalise on cheap credit. A chronic undersupply of housing in most capital cities, particularly in Sydney, along with strong population growth, further suggested pent-up demand for housing, he added. And Esquim Research Director Louis Christopher said his property analytics company was sticking to its previous forecast of double-digit rises in Sydney values this year, despite the virus. Nothing has happened yet to make us revise that. But, he said, the risks are rising. It will depend on how it plays out, and if we see deep fear in the community where people are not turning up for inspections or auctions. And buyers agent and market analyst Simon Presley said in a recent Propertology column that housing market conditions remained, quote, the best in a decade. And they see no reasons to adjust their property market forecasts that were released only a month or so prior to January's onset, he said. To which I reply, well, let's see, shall we? And the HIA has been busy and said, as the Australian government looks to respond to the current global financial uncertainty and to identify appropriate policies and stimulus measures to enact, the residential building industry must be one of the most supported. The residential building industry has a strong track record of underpinning Australia's economic growth and stability. Australia is emerging from a residential building downturn, and in the face of the virus shock, stability and clear direction to ensure the housing market does not take a backward step is essential, they said. The construction industry employs over 1.1 million people, with residential building work generating over $105 billion for the Australian economy in 2018 and accounting for 5.8% of expenditure in the Australian economy. HIA encouraged the state and federal governments to work together in this difficult time to provide policies that will stimulate the residential building sector. Residential building stimulus was a key element to the response to the 2009 global financial crisis, and the results then were very positive. And the Westpac Melbourne Institute Index of Consumer Sentiment fell 3.8% to 91.9 in March from 95.5 in February. The worsening virus outbreak and associated rout in financial markets have had a major impact on sentiment this month. The index has hit a five-year low. In fact, it is the second lowest level of the index since the global financial crisis, when the index bottomed out at 79 with an average read of 86.8 over the period. Therefore, while clearly very concerned, consumers are for now taking a more balanced approach to the situation than we saw during the GFC, they said. Other evidence for this can be found by comparing the family finances and time to buy a major household item components of the index, which register 63.7 and 88.2 respectively at the low point of the GFC compared to the current reads of 82.7 and 111.4 respectively. A sharp rise in job loss fears also suggests consumers may look to delay or cut back on big ticket expenditure items. And the Westpac Melbourne Institute Underemployment Index jumped sharply, rising 8.5% to 146.1 in March. And that's a four-year high, and recall that higher readings indicate that more consumers expect unemployment to rise in the year ahead. Consumers now look to be bracing for a significant deterioration in labour market conditions in 2020, and sentiments around housing also softened. The time to buy dwelling index dipped slightly in March, a 0.3% decline, taking the index to 111.8. While that looks resilient compared to other aspects of the survey, it is unusual for the index to fall following an interest rate cut. With residential property the most interest rate sensitive sector of the Australian economy, home buyer sentiment typically shows an even more positive response to rate cuts than consumer sentiment overall. And the survey detail continues to suggest deteriorating affordability is becoming more of an issue for some segments, with buyer sentiment amongst age groups that drive first home buyer activity showing more of a pullback. And the Westpac Melbourne Institute Index of House Price Expectations fell 6.6% in March, the largest monthly decline since February last year. That said, at 141.7, the index is still well above the long-run average of 125 and is up 66% from a year ago. Most consumers still expect prices to rise over the next year, but the result is consistent with some slowing in momentum. And responses to additional questions on the wisest place for savings shows a slight easing of risk aversion, but coming from a very high starting point. Consumers still heavily favour safe options, with 63% nominating deposits, superannuation, or pay down debt as the best place for savings, compared to 64% in December. The proportion favouring real estate rose slightly to 13% from 10% in December, and a record 40-year low of 9% this time last year. And this may indicate some increased interest from investors. A group that has been less prominent in this current upswing in the housing market than in previous cycles, although the wider shock to sentiment is likely to see investors remain cautious. Finally, the Grattan Institute said Australia currently has 100 diagnosed cases of the virus as at the 10th of March. Countries that have hit the 100 case threshold fall, they say, into two categories. Those that saw rapid spread of the disease, like China, Italy and Iran, and those with a managed caseload, like Japan, Singapore and Hong Kong. Australia, they said, would need to act as soon as possible to ensure we join the latter camp. It took Italy around 2 weeks to go from having less than 100 diagnosed cases to having nearly 10,000 cases. The health system in the richest part of Italy is now struggling to cope with the load. The terrifying maths of exponential growth can see pandemics spread very, very fast. The rate at which the virus spread in Italy is not an outlier. It spread at a startlingly similar pace in Iran, South Korea, and China. A range of other countries now look to be treading a similar path, but not everywhere is experienced a week-on-week doubling of cases. Singapore and Hong Kong in particular have gone down a different path, as did China and South Korea after their initial outbreaks. These countries have introduced widespread social distancing measures, including the closure of schools, universities, childcare centres, public gatherings. And further spread in Australia is now inevitable, they say, as health authorities acknowledged, and Australia can slow or stop the spread of the virus now by adopting social distancing measures that will have a real economic cost. One alternative is to adopt social distancing measures later with an even higher economic cost. The other alternative is to let the virus run its course, which will probably have a very high human cost in shortened lives, particularly of the elderly, and carries the risk of significant social breakdown. So in summary, we are facing right into the teeth of the gale. And of course, the question now is, are the policy levers being pulled in the right direction at the right time? Well, not necessarily so, in my view. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.